3 is a very important number.
And I'll give you 3 reasons why it is. First one is the Trinity. Second one is, I think it's the number of times that brethren dunk when they baptize. Could be wrong on that. And the third reason is, it's the time that Willie said I'm supposed to be done by 3. So I'll try to get over this by that time. The actual 3 reasons that I wanted to bring up 3 is because 3 is a very important number, very easy to remember, and we can think clearly as we present today about 3 things. And so Willie, what he did actually ask me to do was to talk to you in this time about how do you do missions here, okay? So there's missions that can be done elsewhere, but how do you do it here in the U.S.? And so I'm hoping to answer that in 3 parts. One, to tell a little bit of history about our ministry, how it happened, a little bit of some of the failures that I've made in ministry growing up, and then also have a time to share what we view is a really good way to do ministry here, and then also to leave you with some things that you can do, both in helping us and also how you do ministry in the places that God has you. So before I get started, I really like to know my audience, who I'm speaking to, and so I'd like everyone to stand up if you're able. And while you're standing, if you can get out a piece of paper or a phone, all you need to do is at the end of this have 3 names written down, so something to write with. So it can be a phone or a piece of paper. Make sure you have that out or easily accessible. Maybe it's down beside your bench where you're sitting. So everyone, if you have that, and you have health reasons that keep you from standing, you may sit down at this time. But everyone else, if you can, stay standing. And I want to ask, if you have served in foreign missions, I need 3 of you who have served in foreign missions to tell me where. So maybe one of the missions you're already supporting, Ukraine or whatever, but 3 of you who have served in foreign missions, tell me where you served.
Grenada.
Ukraine. Haiti. All right, so anyone who served in foreign missions can sit down. Thank you. All right, so if you've served in a local stateside mission, either in a service to your program or whatever, or just went and served for a day in some capacity, I want to hear about that. So if you served somewhere here in the U.S., if you went to a work project or went to serve for 2 years, tell me about that. So 3 people serving here in the U.S. somewhere. China is not the U.S.
New Mexico.
All right, so New Mexico. What else?
Maine.
Great.
Alaska.
All right, wonderful. All right, for all of those who have served in local missions somewhere here in the U.S., you may sit down. And that includes a service project, a one-day thing. That's fine. In case that's clarifying. All right. And now the rest of you all may sit down as well. Thank you. It's good to know my audience, and thank you for working with me on that. Make sure that piece of paper or your phone is ready to write down at the end the 3 names. So first, a little history. I'm a history teacher, and I love history because history helps us to know how to live today. One, to avoid mistakes, and 2, just to bring a lot of meaning to who we are and what we do. And I think as Anabaptists, we understand the importance of history because a lot of what we do is based on what we were taught, our traditions, etc., and there's a lot of meaning in that. So I want to start with that. So back in the 50s, there was a revival among at least the Lancaster County Mennonites. I'm not sure how far else it went, but a revival in urban ministry here in the U.S. And so there was a whole bunch of churches that were planted in cities around the U.S., and that was the Tidings of Peace was one of those. And it started on Princess Street, which is right around the corner from where we're currently located. And in that place, it was, at that time, separated according to people groups. So there was a Little Italy and Chinatown and that kind of thing. And the location where the church was planted was a black neighborhood and was also a slum. And sometime in the first 10 years or so, the federal government decided that the way to help ethnicities get along is to force them to move together. So we can be the judge whether that worked or not, but what that meant was that they tore down that whole neighborhood and put up high rises and apartment buildings, and they made everyone move, including our church. And so we found a building right around the corner that was a factory, and what they made was a teething solution for babies. So to bring comfort to the babies and also for the mothers who were trying to put their crying babies to sleep. So we are still trying to do the same mission, bringing comfort to people's souls, maybe not their teeth. But that's where we found to plant the church. And God has been faithful in that work. And he also helped us to plant a school. And we'll talk more about that shortly. But about 35 years ago, in June was marked 35 years, my father decided to move into the city. And he was going to be ordained pastor. He knew that before he showed up. At least I hope he did, because he moved in and 2 days later was ordained. So he came to York, and he was the first, the fourth pastor of the church, but the first one to move in. And they had been for the first year of marriage working at interacting with the youth of the city. And they've been doing it from Lancaster. So they were driving in. They would bring youth to other churches for services. They would have them over at their house. They would do all sorts of things. But they decided after a year of doing that, that if they really wanted to engage with the people of the city, they need to move in and live there with them. And so they made that choice. And they moved in right beside the church building. Well, they moved in above the church building. At that point, there was an apartment. And shortly after that, they bought the house right beside the church building. And that is for the first 10 years or so of them living here in the city. They had a part-time, daddy would have part-time jobs, and he would come still preach. He would do the Bible school in the evening, prayer meetings, et cetera, et cetera. And really got involved in some interesting situations, having to take my mom and us children, helped in a domestic violence situation where the dad was abusing the wife and children, and so we had to take them away out of state for a little while, and then sometimes we'd have children living with us or families living with us. Really wanted to engage with what does it mean to be Jesus to these people at this time, and really had no stops in what that meant. He was willing to make any sacrifice. He believed that anything that belonged to him belonged to God, and it could be used for whatever God wanted it to be used for. And so that was a really good example. But as he talked with others who had planted churches in the city, specifically up in Reading, Jay Fox said that if you're going to have a church in the city, you need to have a school in the city. They just go hand in hand, and you really need to have a school. So he'd been thinking about that for a while. Some of the neighbor families were starting to ask if we had a school option. And so we started 25 years ago the school in the building right down the street. And long story, but God gave us that building. And all we had to pay was the closing cost, which somebody else did for us. So that was a miracle. We worked and got that thing developed. And over the 25 years, it grew from 5 students to 25 students. And in that time, Dina Nell served from here, and that was a blessing. She taught me when I was in school at that time. And it grew from that small population to up to 50 students. And in the process of growing, we also realized we need to find a new building. And so just 2 years ago, we bought a new building. We're working at remodeling it. And Neil from here also helped us in the process of working at remodeling that new school building before he had to go to China, and now he's back, and anyway, we're still working on the building. More of that later. So that was Daddy's ministry, and one of the things about growing up in a city with people all around, always doing ministry of some sort, I knew that that's what I needed to do. I was trained that missions is important, and we need to do it, and as I got older, and you know, in the teenage years, most boys think that they're smarter than their dads, and I was no exception. And I just saw how Daddy was pouring his life into the ministry of the school, And I looked at the results and I said, where are all the converts? Where are all the church members? Where are all the people who are supposed to be coming from this ministry in our pews? What's happening? I said, this isn't working. We need something else. And so I started to really put all my eggs in the basket of city street ministry, getting out there, preaching on the street corners, giving out tracts, engaging one-on-one in conversations. I really felt like that was the way that you save people. You get out there and you confront them where they're at. And so I really got into that. And I started going out on Saturday nights. A bunch of the youth there were going out. We just go witness with people and preach to them, give them tracts. We just really felt like we were getting somewhere. But I had a wake-up call one night as I was speaking to a homeless man, and I had my speech memorized about everything I would go through in bringing someone to the Lord. And at the end of my speech, I asked this homeless man if he had a Bible at home. I don't know. You'll get that later. But I started to realize, you know, all I'm doing is simply having a script that I try to go out there and paste on everyone and hope they kind of get saved at some point. And I realized I really wasn't doing that much different than the school. And I started to think about, well, maybe the school is better. Another moment when I had a wake-up call was our church would give out tracts to the neighbors and the surrounding blocks around that. Once a month or so, we'd give out tracts. But I also, as I walked around there, I would give them out randomly as well, just putting them in people's doors. And I remember one day I was giving this tract to the house directly across from the school for the umpteenth time. I don't know how many times I had given tracts there. And the lady of the house came out and just threw the tract at me and just yelled and just really was incredibly angry that I was just giving tracts all the time. And I thought this was persecution for righteousness' sake. But when I stopped to listen to what she was saying and started thinking more about it, I realized that she was just really annoyed that all I was doing was giving her a piece of paper and hoping that she would become a Christian. And just doing that all the time. And never caring to think about who she was or how she was brought up or caring anything about her as an individual. I was just throwing paper at her. And what that helped me to think about was I learned the story of that family eventually and realized that the dad had been the son of a pastor. He had the gospel thrust down his throat all the time, had really had some really hard things, but was really open to knowing, is Jesus real? Is he alive? Does he care? And it was really opening to me to realize if I got to know that family, there was a lot better ways to reach them than just throwing paper at them. And in the process of time, I realized that the ministry of the school was really, really powerful. And there was a way that you could build relationships with people and you could really give them the knowledge of the Bible that they needed in order to become Christians. And so I came around and now I'm the head of the school. So I really do believe in the ministry of the school now, although I didn't when I was a teenager. But the one thing that really changed my mind was when I started to have Bible studies with a young boy from our Bible club who was really a handful, all right? He told me later that he loved to get kicked out of Bible school. He would try everything he'd do to get kicked out of Bible school because he didn't want to be there. His parents were just sending them because they were wanting free babysitting. And so I saw this guy and I said, I need to engage with him in a deeper way. And so I started having him over for Bible studies. And so he came because I invited him, but then he found out there was supper, so he came back lots of times. So I want to introduce you to Keyshawn, and he's with me here today, and he's gonna share with you 3 points about the ways to do ministry well and what worked for him. And so Keyshawn, time is yours.
Good morning. It's a big church. I didn't look back when I came in how deep this goes, but anyway. Excuse my technology, but I couldn't print before I came. So This is a talk that I've given actually three times this week. It's about how I describe it as moving from pedestal ministry to relational ministry. And I think that encompasses the three points that I have. And so while I've shared it three times, it's been different every time. One, because I'm a ranter, but two, because every church is different, right? But before I share those three points, I want to give a little bit of a background as to who I am beyond the boy from Kids Club that tried to get kicked out every Thursday. So I grew up in the city of York. I understand that most of you are becoming far more familiar with York. I don't know if this is breaking a third wall or not, but you were considering planting a church at one point or something like that. And then you partnered. And so I appreciate that. And so your familiarity with York is that it's there. And from there, I don't know how involved you are. But that's my hometown, my home city. I grew up there. I met the Mennonites there. The farthest I've ever been away was 2 years when I attended Faith Builders. And then I returned, and I've been there ever since. When I was about 9 years old, I had a knock on my door, and I was invited to Bible school. It was actually VBS. You guys have a vacation Bible school here? You do? Okay. Well, I didn't see anybody nod their head or shake their head, so I'm just going to assume that you do, and that you know what they are. Anyway, so I was invited to one of those, and I didn't want to be there, and that's where the getting kicked out on purpose thing started happening. If you could have seen my behavior back then, you still might not let me come into church today. I still might be having to pay for the sins of my childhood. I was a really, really bad kid. Now, I would never call another kid bad, but when you call yourself bad, it's okay, right? So anyway, I was a terror, but they saw something in me for some reason that made them want to pour into me and made them want to make exceptions for this really, really disrespectful kid. And so I talked later with a lot of these teachers, and they said it just felt like we couldn't let you go. We had to suspend you because you were physically punching other students and sometimes teachers, but we couldn't let you go. You were always on our mind. And I think that was a God thing. But the turnaround for me, you know, mind you, I was going home, and this is where I explain a little bit of my home life. Both my parents were addicted to crack cocaine up until I was 16, and I moved out when I was 16. So more than half of my life up to this point, I lived in a home that was very, very toxic, very evil, and didn't have a whole lot of love. Contrast that with what many of you have experienced in a loving home where, you know, you eat 3 meals a day together, especially if you're homeschooled. But if you're not homeschooled, at least two, maybe one. I had never eaten at a table with my family before. Never. I say never. Not since I was five. That's my latest memory of eating, I guess. But, you know, as a child, we didn't eat together. And so I was ripe for interaction. I really needed someone to come in and treat me like a human being and not just as someone to be fixed or saved. So when Austin came along, he was coming across a young kid that had been abused, had stepped on crack pipes his entire life, had been sexually, physically, mentally abused. And so I was a lost case in many people's eyes. I was around as a charity case. I was the one that people cared about, but you could never really help because there just was too much going on. Well, Austin, at a young age of 15 or 16, however old he was at the time, was too naive to understand that I was broken and unfixable. And so he just saw a person that he really wanted to pour into. And he did a really interesting job at that. He talked about his scripts. So he came to me with a Ray Comfort Bible and a bunch of prayer calendars and stuff and tried to unload a program on me. Well, I wasn't going to take a program. If you want to relate to me, relate to me. You know, I'm a human being, you know. So that changed pretty quickly. But the one thing that did shape me was when I sat down with the family, and I say the family, I'm not going to say his family because it's my family today. So it's a little bit of a interesting, looking back on it is hard because at that point they weren't my family. But I sat down with the family and we ate together. And by all appearances, they did not rehearse ahead of time how to have guests. They didn't give the talk to the kids. Clayton didn't tell the kids, we have guests over, make sure that you're, you're behaving yourself. And if you know the Shanks, you know that's not how they do things anyway. They never prepared for a guest. Well, I guess we have, but it'd be a pretty special one if we're going to prepare for them. And no, the kids were fighting each other, bickering, loving each other, playing hockey on the table with the jam lids. I mean, it was a regular meal. But for me, it was much more than that. I was, again, for the first time, sitting at a table with a family, eating a meal. I had experienced a more intimate experience with them than I had ever experienced with my parents. I was 10 years old at this point, 11 years old maybe. I've been going to kids club for 2 or 3 years, and I was being ministered to. But it wasn't until someone sat down with me and invited me into their space, which is biblical, by the way, and I'll explain that in a few minutes, and allowed me to become family with them, even if it was just for that one night, that I realized there is something deeper to these white Christian people than just their white Christianity. There's actually a soul, and there was actually, I didn't realize at the time, but there was a Jesus. And that was worth pursuing. Up until that point, there was an unpassable wall. Mind you, that I had thought they put up, cultural barriers, whatever it was, that I was never going to be able to be in, even though they asked me to be in. If you just follow God and you can come to church and you can do all these things, and I'm like, y'all don't get it. It's not possible. Austin and his family showed me that there is something deeper that could transcend the cultural barriers and give me life. And that would help me to be able to love them while they love me. And that, of course, was Jesus. I can't go through my whole life story here because I have 3 points. But I want you to understand that if I would go through my life story, there are lots of painful memories, lots of those things that you read in books from people who went through street life, went through all these things. Well, I lived that. Thankfully, only for 16 years, but I lived that. Eventually, I moved in to the Shank household when I was 16. I went to the school, graduated from there, spent another year messing around in the school and getting in everybody's way. I graduated a year early, and then I went to Faith Builders. And ever since then, I've been back. I'm a school teacher at our school. I've been a member of our church ever since I was 13, so I did become a Christian, if you missed that part, and joined the church there and have been there ever since. Through all of that, the first thing that happened when I became a Christian is Austin made me assistant director of VBS at 13 years old. You can shame him after this if you want to. Maybe not a great decision, but it worked. Worked for me, at least. I mean, I don't know how everybody else felt. But what that did is it immediately immersed me in the investment back into people's lives. To me, it wasn't a program. This was what brought me to Christian people. So I realized this is a gateway. That's all it was. It wasn't like we were going to have altar calls and save people. I mean, that's what VBSs do. They never have been that way. But this is a gateway to potentially create more relationships, maybe one that I could even start. About a year or two later, we started our Big Brother program up again at Austin's lead, but I had pressured him. I said, yo, let's have discipleship programs or whatever. Like, why are we doing so much of pedestal ministry? We need to be relating to people. So thankfully, a young man named Sammy came into my life, who's now living in Florida with a job and about to get married and whatever else. I immediately understood and wanted to invest back in this idea of discipleship because I realized it was the only way it was going to work in the city of York, in our locality. It's one thing to go to New York, Philly, Reading, and pass out tracts for a day. And I'm not against that. Not something I will just go up and do necessarily with my time, but I'm not against those things. But in our home area, it's like Austin said, passing around pieces of paper to our neighbors was not going to be effective. How do we relate to people? In doing that, the last 10 years, I've learned a lot. And I'm not here as a teacher, I'm here as a messenger. although I come from the other end, if you want to say it that way, I've been discipled and I do disciple. I'm not coming as an expert, I'm just passing on the message that these 3 things are important. How do we move from pedestal ministry, as in you are up here and they are down here to listen to you, to relational equity? there's three things. One of them is relational equity. The other two is cultural deference and cultural appreciation. Now, these are concepts that can be really scary to Mennonites, okay? Because they tend to fall into ditches that are undesirable. If you appreciate a culture too much, what will happen? Well, then you'll be influenced by them. And if you're influenced by evil people, then you'll become evil people. Well, I don't think it's that simple. Otherwise, I wouldn't be telling you to appreciate other cultures, right? I think that we tend to stop way too soon when it comes to finding what is valuable in a person. Mind you, that they're made in God's image, that Christ is in them. They bear the image of God. In fact, if they are poor, if they are unlovely, if they are the least of these, like we've projected on them, Jesus identified himself with them and said, the way you treat them is the way you treated me. So the excuse of we're scared is very selfish, right? That doesn't make any sense biblically or in a Christ-like way. That's not a valid way to evaluate cultures. The only other option is to appreciate them. And so when I come across someone who is scared of having their children indoctrinated, they don't want to move in this city because they're afraid their children will move away. They don't want to move in the city because they're afraid they're going to be influenced. They don't want to go to college because this and that. I tell them, and every person that you meet, you can find valuable things that you can learn from personally. And what I have found is that when we decide to learn from others, not only do we become better people, but we will find aspects of God in that person. If nothing, you'll find God's image, and that's beautiful itself. I was sharing yesterday at a large Bible school. They're going to have 600 kids there this week. There's 200 staff. I was talking to the staff. And I told them that when you see a person, your response should be, whoa, right? I mean, you're seeing the image of God. That's incredible stuff. Now, I know that we don't do that. But in the same way that we don't do that, we also tend to look at someone. We don't look at someone and we don't say, well, that person needs fixed. Well, that person needs to be saved by me. That person's evil. Oh, the darkness in their heart. But we act that way. We might not say those things to them, although you might say it in a prayer meeting. You wouldn't say it to them, but you would think that way. Instead, we should see people and we should say, whoa, what a beautiful person and what a potential. I want to love that person. I want to be driven by love. Is that how we're acting in missions, or are we the latter? Are we the fixers, the saviors? Another thing that I said yesterday, maybe I should just say it to you outright instead of saying I said it yesterday. I'm saying it to you as well. We are not qualified to fix people. That's not our job. And what I have found, and I could name you 50 ex-Mennonites of color right here, right now, if I had to list. I said I could. I'm not going to. And they are all unified in this aspect. They left because they felt like projects. Or they left because they were projects, and that led to evil, to bad things. The church became the savior when the head of the church was supposed to be the savior. If we're complicit to that, if we have a mission that is like that, all we're going to do in the world is hurt people. Because one, it's blasphemous. It is absolutely blasphemous for us to assume that we have the power within ourselves to save people. We always have to remember and recognize that that greater is he that is in me than not only that is in the world, but than me myself. I'm a vessel. The power in me is not my own. This is God, omnipotent, omniscient God. We are not able in our relational, social skills to fix people. That's why worldly institutions without God that try to fix people are so unsuccessful. And here we have access to God, to the truth, to the life, to the way. And we're not focusing on that. Instead, we're focusing on how can we fix. Someone who appreciates culture to the full extent will not see it that way. That's why I encourage you to appreciate cultures. To appreciate the urban culture. People have asked me, Keyshawn, the cities are so dark, full of wicked people. And I'm like, that's true, but so are some church buildings. I mean, what's your point, right? People have need everywhere. What's your point? I don't know. I just, what is there good in the, is there good in the city? Like, man, that hurts. There are actually four things I learned from the city that I jumped to right away. One is loyalty. You know, living in gang culture taught me what loyalty was. And thankfully, through being sanctified, I could apply that to the kingdom. But that's not something I learned from Mennonites, which probably didn't surprise you. I didn't learn loyalty from our culture. I learned it before I came, and I've held on to that. I also learned respect. And there's a difference between respect of authority and respect to keep your life. I have a coworker. I said several years ago that if you look at someone the wrong way in the city, you can get shot. And people laugh at that, and they're like, oh, haha, like, it's not that bad. You're not in Chicago. I'm like, okay. You know, my coworker in January, he's walking down the street, and he looks at a guy a little too long, and what does he do? He pulls his gun out. He comes home. He's like, bro, I almost got shot. I'm like, did you look at the guy too long? I kid you not. That's a true story. I knew exactly what had happened to him before he told me. We call it street smarts. There's value in that, especially when you go back into the streets to try to point people to Jesus. That's an important thing to have. Well, I can guarantee you that the Mennonites don't have the street smarts. And I've walked with them to pass out tracts, to do things that they don't have the street smarts. And I don't judge them for that, but if you're going to have a mission in the city, it'd be really, really good for you to figure out how do we learn from the people who are here. And one of those things that you would learn is respect. Because it looks a lot different in the city than it does in this building. Not that the respect that's here is bad, but that it doesn't fully encompass respect, because nobody here is going to shoot you if you don't respect them. But in the city, your life can depend on it. Different extremes. Another thing I learned was caution. Learning to be discreet. Learning not to speak too loudly. And there's an aspect of that here, clearly. But there's also a different aspect of that when, again, your life depends on it. Again, street smarts, knowing what is safe and what is not. And mind you, that does not mean that I allow that to usher fear into my life. I probably won't walk down a dark alley at the middle of the night just because it's not smart. But if God asked me to, I would do it in a heartbeat. It's not fear, it's caution. Finally, I learned to cope with loss. My first major loss was my biological dad. But before that, I had lost a lot of cousins to gunfire. I had lost friends to getting hit by cars. I had lost friends to overdoses. I had lost a lot before I lost my biological dad. When I lost Clayton, and by the way, I was adopted into the family officially a year ago, but I was adopted in 6 years ago, informally. He was announcing me as his son 7 years ago. When he first started doing it was really uncomfortable. Because people come up to me and say, how long have you been his son? I'm like, I didn't know it was his son, okay? It didn't take long before that became real. I moved in with him and became his son. The only reason we did it formally is because, one, it was really important to him to be able to explain to everybody, this is my son, period. Not, this is my son, he moved in a few years ago, blah, blah, blah. Just like, this is my brother, period. I don't know where Diane's sitting, but those are my nieces, that's my nephew, that's my sister-in-law, period. That was important to him. I didn't even want to do it, but it was actually the greatest gift he could ever give me. Those are just four things. I could name you 40. Just four things that I usually go to say, I wasn't taught that when I came to the Mennonites. I had that when I came to the Mennonites. Is there value in the city? Yes. Although my parents were terrible parents, unloving, unrighteous, whatever you want to call it, I learned some really good things. There is stuff to learn. There is value in that person. And until you see it that way, you will be ineffective. And I would suggest that this is why you don't see results in many missions. Overseas, you tend to see a little more just based on the way they're run. But in inner city missions, the results are meager. And I'm not a results-based person, but I'm telling you, I see a connection. And I think a lot of it comes from the failure in these three areas. The second one and the third one I'm going to explain very quickly, as not to take up too much time. Cultural deference. When I'm good friends with a man named Daniel Pollard. You familiar with Daniel Pollard? He's a black man. He's been a Mennonite for many years and has done a lot of overseas ministry. We first met him. I didn't first meet him here then, but he came in the city of York 20 years ago for tent crusades. And so he's been doing a lot of work ever since. But obviously, him being a black man, being Mennonite, having a wife that is a black woman, being Mennonite, not being born in the Anabaptist setting, they've run into some cultural things, put it that way. One example is the church they went to refused for many years to let June, the wife's name, wear a black covering. Now, at first you're like, well, who cares? Just yield your preference. That's biblical, right? Well, what they didn't realize is that in order for June to keep her hair down, she has to put oil on her hair. There's no other way to do it. All right? As someone with biracial hair, if I had long hair and I had to keep my hair down to keep pins in it, trust me, I'd have to put product in. And she's full on black. I'm biracial. So her hair is beautiful. Her hair was made by God. That's something to celebrate, or at least not get in the way of, or say it's not good. You know, I think it's a beautiful thing. But she wasn't embraced and accepted for the way God made her. And so they made her wear a white veil. She went through like 20 white veils in a very small span of time. And the only reason she put up with it was to prove the point so they could get the message that I can't wear white veilings. And they just never listened. Never got the point. They said, bless you, while she had a stained covering on every Sunday. Eventually, they went to a different church. Eventually, I think Daniel took part in really investing in New York and taking part of that church, followers of Jesus in New York. But that would have been a great opportunity for those members to have cultural deference. To say that we don't know, let's talk. I'm not suggesting that a brotherhood refusing to change a standard is wrong. I'm suggesting that the de facto no is what can be a problem. We can get away with it when we're a monoethnic culture, when everybody in the room is white. But when you go into a different culture, which is what cities are multi-ethnic places, when you go there, it can't be that way. Otherwise, it will never become diverse. And I've been telling my church and working alongside with our church to say, if we do not learn to defer where possible, our church will be just as monoethnic 10 years from now as it is right now. And we're the city church. How much more true will that be for other churches? So I don't have time to completely unpack what deference can look like here, but especially, I guess that's my bell telling me to hurry up. That's something that you should consider, especially when you interact with individuals. How can I defer? How can I learn? How can I ask questions? Finally, relational equity. The way that I define this is, how do I treat people in a way that they are equally responsible and have the same amount of power as I do, and how deep this relationship goes? Equal responsibility. We're often, again, afraid of this because we think that if we're not on the pedestal, we're in danger of being overtaken by their evil influences. I think you will find that it communicates a very unloving spirit when that's how you see people. And one example, and I should reference this in closing, one example that I live this out is I have a kids club, except it's not kids, it's youth, and it's not a part of a club, it's just what I do with a few other older guys. We have about 15 youth from the city on any given night that will come Thursdays, and they will come into our homes. I believe that the motto of Luke 14 indicates that we should not have clubs or ministries that happen in neutral spaces. I think we should have kids clubs in our homes. I think we should have youth class on our couches. So that's what I do. I have them come in, and I have them, they cook in our kitchen, they eat with us, we go out to eat sometimes, we do work projects together, we play basketball together, and they decide most of the rules. They decide what the rules are, and they enforce them. One of the reasons I do that is because I think that there's a lot of value in what they think. I think they might do it better than I could. And while I am bringing the gospel message in my Bible time with them, they decide when that happens. They pick the hour. And so while I am the leader and I have the respect and authority of that group, they are making most of the decisions. And that has not produced a dangerous culture. In fact, it's created a brotherhood. Some of these young men are living lives that are trying and actually pursuing a relationship with God. I don't know if you're going to mention Sean or not. He didn't come in through our guys group, but him being there has been really helpful. Young men in the city of color following God because they got to come in and sit on our couch. When you open up your home, when you show deference, when you're appreciative of the person, when you see them as made in the image of God, and when you say, you have just as much say in how deep this goes, I'm not going to laud my authority and my righteousness over you. You have just as much right to say yes or no to how deep we go in this area. That's when discipleship can take place. And I promise you, if those things are followed, you won't run into near as much cultural damage and hurt people. And 10 years from now, instead of having 50 people that I could name you that are hurt and bitter, I'll have 50 people I can name you who are saved. Maybe even among us. Not necessarily, but maybe even among us. So a little bit of my story, a little bit of my thoughts. That's how I would see good ministry taking place in the cities of America.
All right, I promise you we won't stay till 3. I know we're supposed to be done. But I just want to leave you with 3 things. And one is that it is awesome that you guys have decided to partner with us. It's really encouraging. As Aaron held up Moses' hands, that's the view that I have of you guys. It really does a lot just to know that there's a whole church that's willing to help when there's a need. And that's really exciting. And some of the needs are what you can see out there on the display table. There's ways you can support the school with resources and coming to serve at, you helped with the informational supper food, you know, different things like that. That's awesome. That's awesome ways to help lift up our hands. There's also ways in which you can move in. We're looking for a staff care couple. So a retired couple who can help take care of the staff and care for them. That would be an opportunity to make the sacrifice to come and move into the city. That's an opportunity. There's also a blessing that Brother Ken Nell and Clay Godfrey have just joined our school board. That's a great way in which you can come to help serve and be a blessing. So those are awesome things that you can do. The other thing is I want you to think about what Keyshawn shared with you all today. And there's many ways in which the history that you have, the things that you've been brought up with can make you think, oh, well, you know, he said that point, I kind of get it, but it really, you know, let the Holy Spirit work in what he shared and let it be a fire in which it can help you to become what God wants you to be. And so That paper that you got out or that phone that you have, I want you to write down three names of people that you know that you see at least once a week, maybe more. And that could be coworkers, that could be family or friends who are not saved, who need Jesus. I want you to write down those names, and then I want you to focus on praying for those three people and asking God, how can I love them? Not just throw them into a program somewhere, throw a piece of paper at them. How can I love them? And where's opportunities that I can bring them into my couch or to live life with them? That is where real life change happens, and that's how God is glorified. So God bless you as you continue to help us and as you continue to serve God where He's placed you. Thank you.